I guess we shall begin. It's close to three. Small church, big sound. The sort of the dividing line, if you will allow, is most churches in America, 80% run fewer than 100 on any given Sunday. And so we all hear about the mega churches, and they get all the headlines, but they are less than 1% of the churches. So now your church may run 300, may run 500. The class is designed for anybody that has to deal with audio in your church. You're kind of going, well, what do I do with all this stuff? Or, I've been doing this for years, let me kind of get a little refresher here and see if I'm along the right path. The idea is, we're looking at audio in what we call a family worship environment, that is, where we can relate on a standard basis to another person in the church, on a almost a church family kind of environment. That's different than a large church where it tends to be a cluster of small churches. So if you have a church of 1,000, it's typically 200-member churches that are divided up according to either demographics or age, you know, something like that. Then looking at developing some production skills that actually work in the small church, it's one thing to be able to pull something off here where we have resources. It's quite another to do a production in a small church where we're very limited with what we can achieve from the gear. So, practical aspect. Situation, we were called in, I toured with Tommy Walker, and we were called in to do an event for him at a Lutheran church. And so it was for, we're used to working in 3,000 to 5,000 seat rooms, so this is a 1,400 seat room, so relative to what we're used to, it's a small room. What made it very difficult, we could pipe organ here, marble, tile, plaster, glass. Okay. You put Tommy Walker in a room like that, it's going to be stinking loud. So we have to really work toward getting things down. Again, in a Lutheran conference, they were a little more concerned about the volume than we might have, say, in an EB Free church. So practical aspect of the matter was, how do we get this thing to work? So the first thing we did is looked at situations where In a smaller church environment, you have situations. Now, it's not a big a deal out west as it is back east. Back east, we have a real problem with churches that have been in existence 50, 100, 150 years, where it's grown into a relative-based church. That is, it's hard to make the keyboard player turn down her amplifier when she's the pastor's daughter. Those kind of things. Second thing, lack of funds. Small churches don't have dollars, the big churches do. And then finally, we've never done it that way before, which is a big deal back east. I'm from Atlanta, so they kind of give you a perspective on that. Modeling worship, often in a small church, you are the only one doing tech. Large church, you might have three people on audio, two people rotate on lights, two or three people on video. Small church, you're it, you know. So you've got to be queuing up the CD for the track, you've got to getting the video ready to go, and you've got to make sure the lighting cue's set. So a lot of stuff going on. So when you're the one-person show, or maybe there are two people at the most, it makes it really, really hard to do this. So we have a mission statement. It says the goal of us, not just audio, but the tech team, is to provide audio technical services worthy of the work of Jesus Christ. We look at this goal of being accomplished by looking at not just the technical part, but also the physical and spiritual needs of these people on the stage, the pastor, worship team, etc., who've given us God's word so we can deliver it to the congregation. So with that as our focus, then, have the biblical basis for it. We're there to please God and not man. Now, if you've ever done sound, you know that you can't make people happy. It's too loud. It's not loud enough. It's too boomy. It's too thin. I can't hear the keys. All I hear is keys. Why'd you turn my wife down? You know? All those kind of fun things. We're entrusted with the gospel. That is, it's interesting, especially, let me just ask you, how many of you run fewer than 100 on a given Sunday? Okay. And in those churches, it's very easy to think, well, you know, there's just 80 of us here today. It's not that big a deal. It's not that important. But what we don't realize is that Paul said that we're entrusted with the gospel. And so there are two things that last forever, the human soul and the word of God, right? You get to touch the human soul with the word of God every Sunday, whether it's one person or 1,000 persons. It doesn't matter. And because of that value that's placed on you making this happen, it is understandable that we're to seek no earthly glory. That's good, because you don't get any, do you? All you get is the grief. Whatever goes wrong, it's your fault. Right? Wherever they drop the mic, or they forget to turn it on, or they stand in the wrong place, it's your fault. And how do you know? Because the whole congregation turns around and looks at you. Right? So I've got a t-shirt in my office. Turn back around, I heard it too.
Where'd you get that t-shirt?
We had it made up for the company. One of our guys, Tim Slade, he and I have worked together for years for Charles Stanley, First Baptist Atlanta. And Dr. Stanley, everybody calls him Doc, is very prone to stopping a recording of In Touch and saying, if my friends in the sound booth will get the sound right, we'll continue. That's fine. But it's usually something that he does, like doesn't turn on his mic, or he puts his overcoat on top of the lapel, you know, all these kind of things. It happens all everywhere. It doesn't matter. It happens with Joseph Garlington, and it happens with Greg Laurie. It happens with everybody. You know, and they're not being a bad person or unspiritual. It's just part and parcel of tech. You know, things go wrong. We're to be a burden lifter. And this is where it gets interesting, because this scripture we use a lot as our reference. Paul said that we're to be as gentle as a nursing mother is to her newborn child. So, in our little limited version of love that we see and we can understand, it's really the most pure love that a mother would have with her child, right? So that level of care is what you're supposed to give to the drummer. Think about that. That's hard. It's really, really hard. Because if you are the tech in your church, then what you end up doing is babysitting a lot of musicians, right? And you start rehearsal. Everybody's yelling at you. I need more of this. Turn this up. This sounds boomy. This sounds muddy. Hey, I can't hear myself, right? Everybody's yelling at you at once. You're trying to get this thing going. You get halfway through it, and then something goes wrong, and they start yelling at you again. Well, if you're in the flesh, pretty soon you start yelling back, right? It's a natural human tendency. Then you have this whole Hatfield-McCoy, us-with-them kind of scenario where you build Fort Sound around you, and anytime anybody says anything, you spat technobabble back at them, right? And you kind of get them off base just by yelling at them with technical stuff. Not a healthy environment. Paul said that we are to be gentle with people and look at lifting their burdens. Now, it's really hard to lay on a technician even more than they're dealing with, especially in a small church, because again, you know, you've got a 16-channel Mackie mixer. That's what you've got, you know. It's not going to get any bigger. You know, you're not going to pour water on it and sprout four more channels next week. It's what you've got. And so the worship leader wants to do this big production, you know, and they've got a budget of $4. You know, so what do you do? So you're going, well, it's hard, you know. There are four SM58s in the church. You know, that's what it is. You're laboring night and day, and if you're like most church sound techs, you're pretty much giving up most of your free time for this and most of your disposable income that you're not even counting as a tithe, because you stop at the music store on the way home and pick up some cables and those kind of things. And it's very hard to become this kind of person that Paul's telling us we should be when you're just getting yelled at all the time and spending all your money. So here's a little encouragement. What a reading of the scripture tells us is that if we are there to please God and not man, and we realize that we have a stewardship of the gospel, we're looking out for the heavenly aspect of this, we're lifting our burdens, we're working night and day, but that, in effect, creates a spiritually mature person, because that creates, as Paul said, someone who is holy, just, and blameless. In this reference, he's telling the church there that he's about to yell at them about what they're doing wrong, but before he does so, he says, here's why I have the authority to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Bang, 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 bang. So what Paul is telling us is that this character in our lives creates this in our heart. It's very difficult for a technician to go to church. You say, I'm there all the time. Well, you're there working, you're not there with the service. Because when the pastor's speaking, most of us who are doing the sound are not listening to the sermon. We're listening for, what is that little funny ring when he steps over there? And God, please don't let him walk over there where the wireless doesn't work. Please don't let him walk, you know, over there. We're focused on those kind of things as opposed to what the actual text of the sermon is. So we often lose some spiritual aspect of what we're doing. Well, Paul understands that, and so he is telling us that these sacrifices we make are not just for the church, not just for the worship leader or the pastor, but they are for our own edification. That God is using these circumstances to create in our lives something that he considers worthy of his calling. So we become an axios, a worthy servant, through our servantship to others. So when the drummer's yelling that he wants more drums in his drum monitor for the umpteenth time, and it's already so loud there's a hole in the wall, right? That's when we have to really reach deep and say, okay, God, I can't deal with this anymore. You're going to have to help me out here. And we walk up to the stage and we have a civil conversation with a person that we would really just like to take out back. You know? So, having said that, here's some part of the science of it. One of my professors at Georgia Tech was Dr. Eugene Petronas. And he said, sound is simply noise we want to hear. Isn't that cool? Instead of reading in a technical dictionary a seven-sentence definition of sound, he said, hey, it's just noise we want to hear. It's wanted noise. He went on to explain it to me this way. He said, you get in your car, turn on the radio. You hear a song, you do. You turn it up. You hear a song you don't like, you turn it down or change the station, right? Same sound. Whether or not you liked it, made it noise or music. So if you like Third Day and you turn it on, you get in the car and you turn on whatever the Christian station is and you hear a wire come on, hey, that's cool. You turn it up. It's sound. You don't like Third Day, it's noise. Here's the big problem. Sound is totally perception-based. It's what you want to hear. Now, the other 80 people in church, guess what? It's totally perception-based. It's what they want to hear. Now you understand why they always sell. It's come up to you and go, you know, why did it sound so bad today? And you're going, it was a great mix. Right? Because it's perception. It's whether or not you liked it. And it may not have been the actual mix. It might have been the music. It might have been what the person who was singing was wearing, honestly. It might have been the little smirk they had, the little Billy Idol smirk they had on their face that converted what would be a great song into noise. So here's the big deal. Everybody on this planet knows two things. Their job and sound. So you get used to it. You're mixing. Somebody's going to come up to you. There's a t-shirt at Mix Magazine, which is just hilarious. And they come up to you while you're mixing and ask you these crazy questions. Like, where's the bathroom? You're not the custodian. You're not the usher. You're part of this band who's up there playing. They wouldn't walk on stage and ask the bass player, right? But it's okay to ask you. You know why? Because you're the only member of the band that's a member of the congregation. You're the liaison. So all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, I'm at the center of a big fulcrum that does this. You're the center of the hourglass. So everything that comes off that stage and goes out to the congregation, guess what? It goes through you. Now, if you were to sing a solo, you might be on stage 5 minutes, right? That's your time. So you can mess up 5 minutes of the service. If you're the worship pastor, maybe 20 minutes. If you're the pastor, 30 minutes. 40 if you're Baptist. Okay? Guess what? You are on there the whole hour, right? Now, if you were Satan and you were going to create a strategy for screwing up service, what would you do? Would you go after this person, or this person? There you go. Put a big old grain of sand right here and you stop the whole thing up, right? So guess what? Some of this is technical and some of it is a spiritual battle. So sometimes when you're having a really bad day, that's just the thing that needs to put you over the edge so that you go up there and yell at the bass player or drummer and create this whole animosity. You didn't do anything wrong. It's just that everything falls to you. Because nothing happens up here and gets out here unless it goes through you. You've got to amplify it. You've got to EQ it. You've got to tonally get it. You've got to record it. You've got to get it on the screen. All these kind of things. So now we realize, hey, you know what? I'm not just the flunky here. This is a critical aspect of what goes on. So we call you a worship tech because you are the technician that creates an environment conducive to worship. So you're important, not because you're great and gifted and all these kind of things. God can give a million people that ability. What you're good at is staying out of Satan's lair and keeping that little flow open. So it takes a spiritually mature person to do this job. If we look at sound and we say, okay, sound is wanted noise, then a more complete definition might be sound is what happens when air gets pushed. Now, if we look at a typical church environment and we look at the sound that's going on in the room, what you soon realize is in a small church, if you've got this much volume that can happen in the room, that's how much volume you can fill up the room. You know, at this level, when it's full, that's when people start walking out, you know, or coming back and complaining. And they go, it's too loud. And you say, well, you're too old. You know, so. At this point, you have to stop making it louder. Okay. Now, if I'm the acoustic drummer, and I'm in a small room, 150 people, and I play my drums, I fill up 40% of the sound in the room with my drums. If I were to go to electronic drums and use a monitor, I'm at 10%. If I'm a electric guitar player and I use an amplifier, I might take up 20% of the sound in the room. If I'm the bass player, I might take up another 20%. Well, guess what I just did? The drummer, the bass player, and the guitar player just took 80% of the available volume for the whole room for themselves. So we've got 100 people here, three people take 80%. So three people versus 80 people. So 80% of the room gets 20% of the sound available to them. And three people get four-fifths. That's not fair. The guitar player says, I have to have it that loud in order to worship. I've got to have my all-tube, 50-watt, 410-amp, and it's got to go to 11 before I can worship. How deaf is your God? You know? I won't play a Pod XT. I won't play V drums. They're not real. Okay. So if I were to play a Pod XT, and let's say that my tonal quality would drop 20%, okay? The difference between the real thing and an emulation, 20%. But I were to give back all this volume to this congregation, my sacrifice of praise is not how cool I can play all my great licks and my tone, it's I gave up my volume. I gave it back to God. I gave it to the congregation. Are we not there for the congregation? Are we there just to hear ourselves play? So if the drummer says, I'll give up the acoustic drums and do V drums, and then all of a sudden all of this volume goes back up here, wow, this is cool. All of a sudden, this becomes a spiritual sacrifice. It becomes a gift back to God, a gift back to the congregation. And now, the poor sap back here trying to mix all this mess actually has something to mix, because in this scenario with these live instruments, you're back at the board. Take the main left-right faders, move them all the way up and all the way down. The only thing that changes is the vocals come in and out a little bit, right? You're not mixing. You're riding herd on top of a bunch of chaos. Okay? You're trying to get the vocals on top of the band. Stupid. It's a no-win situation. If the band gives up those things and gives it back, the whole volume can come down and the vocals can be clearly heard and the mix sounds wonderful. And what did we do to give up that? We gave up about 20% of the overall tone personally. Guess what? 99.5% of the people in the congregation can't tell the difference between a Pod XT and a 412 Marshall stack. They can't tell the difference. So if we can give up our volume and give it back to the congregation, and we can start to become a team that says, hey, we're here for the congregation, then all of a sudden things just start to work again. And we can start to say, hey, instead of me having all of my wedges here, all of these loud stage monitors, if I give that up, and I get me an Avion system, and I put my ears in, and I drop all that stage volume, then what did I do? Is it the same? No, it's not. Will you feel the energy the same? No, you won't.
But is it enough for you to stay on time and on pitch? Yeah. And guess what? All of a sudden, instead of all this chaos out here, it's actually clean and clear here. You can drop the overall level. Now, if you're a professional musician, you actually have hearing when you're 50. Okay? So you can stay in this job and not have to go get a real job somewhere. Then things start to work. And like, okay, this is really pretty simple. Until we run into the fact that all these people are human beings and they don't want to do this, do they? So, here's what we have to do. We have to start looking at the technology of this. Sound is a wave, and our big problem we run into is wave interaction. That is, if I have, say in my church environment, that we've got a fan-shaped auditorium stage here, and I've got an acoustic energy source back here, that energy spreads out. Well, if I mic it and it goes through the speaker, it spreads out here. Well, these things interact. Or if I have a lectern mic, and this lectern mic is on, and I walk up to it with my lapel mic on, the distance from here to here, D1, versus D2, is different. So this energy gets here before this energy gets here. It shows up back to the mixer as what we call time incoherent. It's late. And it's this kind of swishy, washy, phased kind of sound. So we are creating problems the more sources we have and the more output devices we have. So one of the biggest things we can learn about sound is the fewer inputs and the fewer outputs, the better it sounds. If I can have one speaker do the job, then I don't have to worry about where the sound goes. If I can have one mic do the job instead of three choir mics, I don't have to worry about the interaction of all these things. We were asked to do sound for this church in Atlanta. The church runs 4,000 every Sunday. They only hold 1,200 in each service. It's the capacity of the room. So the pastor asked us to come in last Easter. They rented a Walmart. Walmart had just moved, closed this store, opened a Super Walmart, typical Walmart kind of fashion. They rented the room, brought in 4,400 folding chairs and us. And we did audio, video, lighting, and data control. Imagine sound in an empty Walmart. 14-foot cinder block walls, concrete floor, metal ceiling. Okay? Not a pretty sight. What we did, instead of blasting sound all around, we had 9 concentric rings of delays. We had over 40 speakers in there, each one time zero reference with the Timex system back to the pulpit, so that acoustically the signature was here, and everything related to that. We spread about 14 projection systems throughout the room, and we took care of the lighting. We had it sounding so good that when the ABC affiliate for Atlanta came out to do a little story on it, instead of plugging in line input, the tech just put a mic out. He said, sounds great. Because we learned some very cool tricks. First thing we learned to do is get control of that crazy stage vibe. Everybody on stage had to use an ear, a pod, a something that didn't make lots and lots of noise. Because if I had acoustic drums back here against this cinder block wall, all this effort would have gone to pot the minute he hit that snare. It has to be done. People ask us all the time, why do you harp on this so much? Well, here's the deal. If we look at a side aspect of a stage, and let's say I've got a floor monitor here on this stage, and I say, turn me up in the monitor. It's fine, turn it up. I got the drums and the bass and all this stuff back here. Does that sound stop when it hits the magic infrared wall of the stage? No, it doesn't. Guess what it does? It goes out there. Now, it would be one thing if it was good sound. But remember where that monitor is pointed. It's pointed here. So what if you go down to Best Buy and you go into their nice little home theater room, you sit down on the black leather sofa with the ferns on the end, and you're going to buy a new speaker system from them, a nice 7.1 surround. And they say, what's your favorite DVD? And you tell them, and they pop it in and say, oh, just a second. Before I turn this on, let me fix the speakers. And they walk over to the speakers and turn them all around backwards. They hit play. How's it sound? Sounds horrible, right? You hear the back of a speaker. Guess what the audience hears every Sunday morning? The back of the speaker. So these first 5 rows, it's just like noise. It's just a backwash, which is late relative to the ear because it's further away. It's a backwash. Plus, the energy that bounces up here, goes up here, comes back down here, and now there's a third anomaly going on. It's just sound all around. we've got to control the stage volume. Does it mean you can't ever have a stage monitor? No. Tommy Walker will not use ears. There will be stage monitors next week at Purpose Driven. What will I do? I have to work around it. But I can't have stage monitors for everybody. Bob Wilson, the drummer, will use ears. Jerry Watts on bass will use ears. Finn Johnson on keys will use ears. See what I'm doing? Linda on vocals will not use ears, but the other two backgrounds will use ears. So wherever I can, we reduce the volume. You're always going to have a holdout. You pray for that person, you know? Pray that God takes them out. And then the other problem we have is, let's say that we have in here a subwoofer. You know, and this subwoofer's pumping out all our nice bass here, and it's just blowing sound. Well, guess what? That subwoofer is just as loud right here as it is right here, as it is right here, as it is right there. It doesn't care. Low frequencies are huge. They're 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet long. They go everywhere. Red light. Sitting here waiting in a red light. Kid pulls up and an eclipse. Boom, 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 right? Kick drum. Lots and lots of kick drum. Why? Low frequencies are large. They get out of the car. They come through your windows if it's not even there. And bother you. Low frequencies go everywhere. So what we're going to do is control low frequencies. Over in our mixer, we have all these auxiliaries which send signal to monitors and effects. I'm going to use this one down at the bottom for my subwoofers and only turn up signal to subwoofers that make sense, like bass guitar, kick drum, synthesizer. Guess what doesn't go there? Hi-hat, overheads, those kind of things. Because anything that would come from my hi-hat mic and get into the subwoofer is not hi-hat, right? So we're trying to reduce energy wherever we can. Third thing to do is, remember we talked earlier about the situation where the pastor's daughter is the one on the keyboards and she has two KC500 amps cranked next to her ears. So you go to the pastor and the pastor talks to her daughter and says, hey, you know, could you turn down, the daughter turns down for one service and then gets in the spirit, Christian cop out, I'm going to play as loud as I want to, right? You go back, turns down, turns back up, scenario. Take a CD burner, take a cassette deck, put a mic up back at the mixing board, hit record, take it to the pastor. Pastor, here's what I'm talking about. Just hit play. This is what it sounded like this morning. What do you hear? A propensity of keyboard. You know what? The keyboard was off in the house. Completely off. What you're hearing is just her amplifiers. There is no question. This is not I said, she said. There's no argument here. It's like, there's the fact. If you want to subject your congregation to that, you're the boss. But hey, this is what it's going to sound like every Sunday until she turns down. So now you have empirical evidence that, hey, this keyboard is too loud on the stage. Since low frequencies go everywhere, we think about all this kind of stuff here. We think about acoustic energy. That is, in a small church, there's only so much room for the sound to go. So Jeremy, who's the sound tech here, they brought in the SLS speakers, and this is really too small a room for what they're trying to do, in the sense that the larger the room, the more forgiving it is of what we can get by with on volume and where sound goes. In a small room, boy, it's got to be right, because it doesn't. There's no place for it to go. There's not a dissipation curve. Energy dissipates at a relative constant rate because each molecule bumping into the other causes heat, and so we dissipate the acoustic energy as heat, which is kind of cool. Two things stop sound, dead air and mass. So if I have two walls here, when the energy hits this first wall and then it has to convert to go through that solid medium and then reconvert to go through the air and then to convert to go to the solid medium, I'm slowing it down. I'm making it lose energy every part of this. So this is what we'll often do. If I can make this into mineral fiber and use a Z-clip, like the letter Z, to hold it an inch and a half off the wall, wow, I can do some cool stuff. I can make energy really, really slow down. What we don't want to have happen is just to have a wall back here, because when the sound comes in like this, it goes right back like that. And angle of incidence, same as angle of reflection. So if I've got a snare drum on stage and this is the back wall and the snare is hit, it goes bink, bink,
and you're on stage, and you're not sure which one is you and which one's the back wall, right? So it's very detrimental for a musician. It's also detrimental for the congregation because they get confused. They can't tell which part they're supposed to clap to. So it gets very difficult to deal with. Microphones are one thing we can fix really fast. Microphones are cheap, inexpensive ways to solve problems. Microphone's the first thing that happens in a sound system. It converts acoustic energy, sound waves doing this, into electricity. Because of that, we can change mic out. Now, this is the official mic of all audio. This is SM58 for sure. So everybody has one of these, right? It's a rule. You have to have one. So an SM58 is very simple and it's very robust. Here's why. Because it is Atom. It's the guy microphone. Dynamic mic. It's acoustic energy, converts it to electricity because of the moving coil out the back end. You can take this mic, drop it on the floor, pick it up, and it still works. Cool thing. You can give this to the youth group on Friday. Get back on Monday, it still works. This is cool. Notice the little dent here, right? Your SM58s have little dents too, don't they? Your SM58s probably have paint scratched off, and they smell a little funny. All SM58s do. There are no new ones. They just recycle the old ones. You know, that is the theory on Sharpies. Anybody here use Sharpies? There are only 10,000 Sharpies ever made. When they get a homing signal, they crawl back home. They get reconverted with new ink, and they send it back out. Do you know that? That's why you always lose your Sharpie. The idea of an SM58 is that as a dynamic mic, it has a very robust design. It's real simple. It's really good for loud things. So if I have a loud singer, I put a dynamic mic on it. If I have a guitar amp, I put it on here. If I have a snare drum, an SM57, basically the same mic, I put it on here. Do not use these for choir or grand piano or pulpits, and not what they're made for. These are very simple, dumb things. That's why they're guys, okay? Guys have two needs upon earth, food, ESPN, right? That's it? Right? Condensers are the female microphones. They are very complicated and expensive. They are expensive. Yeah. They don't like the cold. All sorts of problems. But if you're trying to have something that really listens, that has detail about it, that's a condenser. So we'll often have small condensers that we use, say, in a choir mic application. And we've got these choir mics set up like this. And this mic may be suspended down from the ceiling and brought in like this. And this choir mic is able to pick up, say, 10 or 12 people from a distance without any problem at all. If we have a condenser on a, say, on a grand piano, we can do some pretty cool stuff there in that we can take a boom mic stand, this is middle C, bring in our condenser here, bring in a condenser back here, and if this is 4 inches behind the hammers and 2 inches above the strings, pointed down at a 45-degree angle so the back of it is pointed at the lid, this gives us a really clear sound because we're going to put it, if you're the pianist and you were to sit down here, your hands fall to these positions, and this mic is basically going to be right above your right hand. It's not going to listen to the low frequencies. We've got a mic down here for that. But when I'm mixing with an ensemble, guess what? I'll basically turn that mic off. During a solo or an offertory when the piano's playing, the mic comes back on. This mic stays on because the only part that makes it a piano in the mix to the average person sitting there is what's coming out of that mic. That's the clarity aspect of it. You say, well, it sounds thin. Yeah, it does until you put a bass player. You know, the bass players that do that now. And so when the ensemble's playing, when the band's playing, we roll off the low end on the piano, simple way to do it is mute that mic or turn it down. And then when the pianist is playing an offertory or a solo or playing accompaniment by herself or himself with the soloist, then we turn that mic back on. Make sense? The microphone, whether it's a 58, whether it's an SM81, whatever the mic may be, is going to be typically in a live environment, going to be a cardioid or a supercardioid mic. That is, it listens to sound here and is completely dead on the back on a cardioid. So the taper looks like the human heart, that if you were to hold it upside down, it looks like that, the polar plot. It's very sensitive here, somewhat sensitive here, dead back here. We're going to use this to our advantage because we're going to set up situations where the back back of the mic is as important as the front of the mic. And here's what we mean by that, is that the problem is we're not going to always get rid of these stage monitors. We're not always going to get rid of these amplifiers. We're going to end up with situations where we have to deal with these things. So if I have a stage monitor here, and I have a vocalist here, if they'll use that microphone and they'll point the cable at the horn, then it won't feed back. If they forget and they lean forward, it's going to squeal. If we can have them remember, point the cable at the horn, it's going to solve problems. We can actually physically take that mic down to that point and it won't feed back. It gives us such ability. If we have a position where we're in a really tough room, say you're meeting in a gym or a portable environment, something like that, we may take a supercardioid mic or even a hypercardioid mic, and if we were to look at it from its side point here on its pickup pattern, it's going to be very sensitive right here, but it's got a null point right here and right here. It doesn't listen to sound from the side. So if I have three vocalists and I've got two monitors, I can put the monitors in between them, and now the null point of that mic of all three points directly at the monitor, which is wonderful. So it allows it. It tells you right on the side of almost every microphone, whether it's a cardioid, and it'll even often show you the little diagram of how it works. If you have any question, you can pretty much go to their website, whoever, Shure, AKG, Yamaha, whoever, and check it out and find out pretty quickly where you need to point that thing. Anybody here use wireless mics? You heathens, you. It is against biblical edict to use a wireless mic. This is an example. We do a lot of work with the University of Georgia, so we're typically using 32 wireless simultaneously with them. So we've got 16 here and then 16 on the other side of this channel, of this 32-channel console. So that entire console is doing nothing but wireless mics. So you try to get 32 wireless mics to work at once. It's tough. So we've got a little computer off to the side, and it figures out what frequencies are available, and even that doesn't always work. The problem with wireless mics is that you're just introducing an entire new set of problems. It's not too much unlike a cell phone in the sense that you create a little radio station and you transmit somewhere and you have to get information back and forth. The biggest issue we run into with wireless mics is when we try to do more than three or four. Up to three or four, pretty much you can use anything. After that, we've got to have a more selective system. Second problem we run into is in a crowded environment like in Southern California, so much RF energy is already out there that for you to try to weave your way through it makes it difficult, if not impossible. Here's what we can do, though. A couple of things we can do. First thing is realize that wireless mics transmit through the air. If you read your Bible, you soon learn that Satan is the prince of the power of the air. You're on his turf. Right? He's got a Bearcat scanner down in hell. He's zipping around looking for you just to show up. So here's what we try to do. Five little rules that we use is line of sight. That is, these are the receivers back here, right? So we've got these master antennas set up back here. But here's an example. You can see this is an ancillary, this is a Shure system here. That antenna right there needs to see the transmission antenna at all times. So if we've got a handheld, that antenna sticking out the back or the one on the body pack needs to be able to see this one. So this is why we can't, this is up, this is in the middle of the University of Georgia's main performance theater. That's why these are not down underneath the console. They're up because we want to have these things line of sight and secondly, minimum distance. We try to keep it as, we're off side of the stage here, we try to keep this thing as close to this stage as possible. So if you can, we recommend, go ahead and get your wireless receivers right off stage, put them into the snake there, and get them down, as opposed to putting them back to the booth. If your booth is 50 feet away, it's probably not a big deal, but if your booth is 80 feet away, or it's using a lot of aluminum in it, or any kind of metal, if you've got to have a metal rack that go in all this, we're using SKB racks of the plastic, so we're not getting RF confusion. We want to have as close as possible this input device to that output device. Third thing, gain and squelch.
On your little body pack, it says gain, which is volume, and squelch, which is noise reduction. We want to leave those at 12 o'clock unless something weird is going on. Application. Small church, you got two handheld wireless, but you got five or six people that use it, right? Check and see, all right, this person, these are our loud people. These two are the quiet people. So I'll take one handheld and turn the gain down and put a piece of red tape around the bottom of it. Take the second one, turn the gain up, put a piece of blue tape on it. All you loud people, you use the red mic. Quiet people, you use the blue mic so that the output is about the same. I'm trying to keep that together. Connector care, notice how tiny those little connectors are. They do that on purpose, so you buy more of them. If you want to test your Christian faith, try soldering a TA4F on Sunday morning. That's a lot of fun. You know, it just breaks off all the time. What we try to tell people, especially pastors, is if you'll just make sure that your loop throughs are not around the body pack. In other words, if this were your body pack, we don't want you taking it and pulling it hard around there. Just form a loop off to the side and tuck it up under the clip so that it's very loose and there's a lot of give here. Because wherever that strain is where we're going to have to end up resoldering that connector. And then finally, battery usage. You ever notice that the entire sound system runs on that one battery? Pastor speaking, it quits. There ain't no PA, guys. It's all over. It's a very embarrassing thing when you've got all this PA, even a small PA, $10,000, $12,000 PA, and the battery quits. Because all of a sudden, everybody knows you did it. And this time, it is our fault because we could have fixed that. So what we do is, and this may be a little extreme, but we suggest Sunday morning, you know, one week of worth of services for a mic and then for a battery, and then that battery goes away and never comes back again. You know, physically, we take a Sharpie and we put B on it for bad, and we take it out of the room. Don't just throw it in the trash can. It'll go back, you know, take it away. We've got a couple of rules here we follow for microphone usage. Let's say that we have a choir mic application here. If I have a mic that's open here, it needs to be three times the distance, point to point, that it is point to source. So if this is 1 foot, this needs to be 3 feet. Make sense? What we're after here is if it's less than that, this mic is going to pick up this person. We only want this mic picking up this person. Because if this mic is picking up this person, then we get that time and coherence again. So if we can keep it away, so if we look at a side view of it, let's say we did a side view of this same scenario where we had a choir mic, then this person standing here would have a mic 2 foot in front of them and 2 foot above them. If I'm the front row of the choir, I'm going to be able to take a 45 degree angle of my arm and maybe just touch the tip of the mic on my toes. That's where it needs to be. So often, you'll see churches do this. Like, okay, not 12 feet, 2 feet. That is an air conditioning vent mic. That's a choir mic. Bring that baby down. So that's a big, big rule. The other one is the close miking technique. So if I'm miking a guitar amplifier, which we hate to do that, right? Now, one thing we can do on Jamie Harville, you guys know Jamie Harville, Ancient of Days, We Believe and all that. When I go out with Jamie and mix for him, Jamie's on stage, his PD Classic 5410 amp is back in the dressing room, and I'll mic it back there with an SM57, run it to a wireless transmitter, send it out the front of house, and then back to his ears. It's cranked to 11, he's happy as can be, but it's 80 feet behind the stage, it's away. But if we're miking this guitar amp, let's say we've got our little guitar amp here, and we've got a single 12 in there, we're going to mic it right there, halfway between the center of the dust cap and the edge of the surround, because that's where our energy source is. That's where all the meat of the tone is. Now, you can do this, but you can change it. Out here, it's going to sound thinner. In here, it's going to sound more robust or boomy, depending on if it's good or bad. But halfway in between is where we're going to do it, and if we were to look at it from the side angle, then our mic's going to be
inch off the grill and 45 degree it in, so that if this is the center of the speaker here, it's going to be right underneath that, basically pointing right there. And it works really, really well. It's a typical SM57 kind of application, or the new cool thing to use is the Audix i5, which is a really great, versatile microphone. We never come in straight. We always come in at an angle. And we use the back of the mic. That is, where we just had this, shouldn't have raised it, but where this mic was, you know, pointing up like this at the grill cloth here, then that lets us put the monitor back here. So the back of this mic is pointed at the monitor. So that would be the front of the mic. This is the back of the mic. So now that energy that's going here hits the back of the mic where the mic is dead. So it saves us bleed over. And then we get to mixing. Knob turning. Knob turning is fun. Typical.
Ken?
Yes, sir, please.
On the 3-1 rule?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
What about you have vocalists standing next to each other on the platform?
Right. They need to be holding those mics no more than a fist distance from their mouth. It's a 3-inch working distance. So we tell them, if they'll hold the typical 58 kind of mic, if they'll hold it just like this, it works really well. And the reason for it, we don't want them holding it like this. Perpendicular is going to pop all the P's. It also blocks that connection. That's performance. This is worship. And by bringing the mic down 45 and 20 degrees off axis on the vertical plane, it gives that plosive energy, the P's and the B's, all that plosive energy is very, it's in a 20 degree vertical slot, so it's all right here. And when I move the mic off right here, all that plosive energy goes away, so it won't pop the mic anymore. And if I'm 3 inches away, then I only have to be 9 inches to the next person, which gives me plenty of working room for the 3-to-1. Does that make sense? Yeah.
What about the ones that like to use the mic stand?
Yeah, that's fine. We just really, like this, we do this with Paul Blosch all the time, because he'll either be using a VX10 or an SM58, depending on the application. So if we've got Paul here on the mic, as long as he's going to work this mic somewhere in this region right here, about no more than 5 inches away, we're okay. It's when he does this and starts singing, there's not much I can do. Now with the VX10 I can, because it's condenser, I can go out and grab him, but it's going to pick up the cymbals. You know, there's no free lunch. So he's got to be willing to do this. Now that's why when he's on ears, he can tell immediately when his voice goes away. Ears will make them get in there. And especially if you can keep the send on the ears down, then that way they have to kind of help you out to make it work. But they can certainly work that mic, and he can even do this, Bruce Springsteen kind of thing with the other person coming in. And it's okay, because the SM58 is so broad in its pattern pickup. Good question. And then on our mixing, here's the big deal. Sound, you don't have any choice as to what they give you. It's not like I can go up to the keyboard player and go, okay, now on this song, I want you to play just these notes. You know? They don't do that. What they do is they do what they want to do. So the idea is this. If we were to do a recording, you know what we have? We have a blank canvas, right? So it's just like painting, where I would put my reds and my greens and my blues. I would put my colors up there. That would be recording. Live sound is the opposite. I start off with a big piece of granite. And the band says, here, make music out of that if you can. Right? They just throw the thing at you. They're playing all that stuff and singing all that stuff. So my job back here is to take my mixing console as an ice pick and start chipping away on this thing until something like music shows up. The best visualization of that is Michelangelo's David. The sculpture of the David. Michelangelo was asked by one of his patrons who paid for it, how in the world did you take a big piece of rock and make that? He said, it wasn't that hard. I just took away everything that wasn't David. Isn't that cool? He took away everything that was not elemental to that structure. He took away everything that wasn't part of the music. So that means when I'm doing a sopranist and her lowest note is A220, guess what? Everything in her microphone below A220, I turn it off. I take the bass knob and go, bink. That's at 80 hertz. So that's her lowest note. Anything below A220 in her mic is Bob baritone. Every time. So we're going to kill that sucker. If I have hi-hat, everything below 400 hertz, it goes away. Why? Everything below 400 hertz isn't a hi-hat. Or if it is, I don't need it for live sound. And live sound is all about damage control. It's like, okay, I've got too much stuff. I got to whittle this down to something that sounds like music. Individually, it might sound thin or weak. But when you put the whole package together, which is what we're after on the whole mix, then it starts to come to life. And it's really kind of cool. What did we do? But we can actually do this part without it, because the whole idea is I'm going to start taking things and paring it down. I'm going to think about, okay, kick drum, bass guitar. I'm going to take about my acoustic guitar and electric guitar as a yin and a yang. My electric guitar is going to give me the meat. It's going to give me this fullness. The acoustic guitar is going to give me this nice brightness. Except when the electric guitar is going to take a solo, then I'm going to bring the acoustic down and bring the electric up. There's not room for everybody at the same time, but there's room for everybody at some time. Something has to give. So we start by thinking on the terms of this would be low frequencies, these would be high frequencies. Again, 1,000 variables. Is this a Strat? Is it a Les Paul? Is it a Tele? Is it hot rodded? You know, what are we doing here? But if, let's say that we've got a 3-single coil Strat here going through a single 12 amplifier, basic scenario. I don't want it jangly like a Tele, but I don't want it to just have just guttural low end like a humbucker setup. I want it to have kind of this nice fill here. So it's going to handle that. Acoustic guitar, the last thing in the world I need in an acoustic guitar is 1,000 hertz. The last thing I need are 1K. So if you have low, mids, and highs on your acoustic guitar, most of the time people do this. They do it right. They do this. You might boost the lows a little bit, boost the highs a little bit, and you pull the mids out, right? Because we're trying to get rid of that whole nasally tone, makes it sound like a cheap acoustic guitar, out of this point by pulling out 1,000 hertz. Guess what that makes room for? Vocals. It also makes room for the electric when it needs its little riffs and leads. Keyboards, since they can cover lows, mids, and highs so well, we have to be really careful about what they're doing, because not only can they sound like a piano, but they sound like an organ, string, pad, whatever. And the biggest deal, if we have a digital piano, say we've got a Yamaha P250, we've got an RD700, a Roland, we've got an ES1 Kawai, whatever it is, biggest thing we can do is take 800 hertz and cut it by 4 to 5 dB, because it sounds honky. You ever notice when they demo the digital pianos to you, they go kaboom, ching, right? And they do a little run up. What they don't do is sit and play in the middle. You know where it sounds terrible? Right in the middle. So we take about 600 to 800 hertz and we typically pull that out. That also makes room for the female vocals, whose main range is right in that region, right around 800 hertz. And so we're starting to pull things out to make room for other things. That's the entire concept that we're after. If we look at the EQ, did anybody not been through the whole mid-sweep kind of thing? Have we done that with you guys? I know most of you guys. Anybody not? Have we not done the mid-sweep with anybody? Where we talk about the radio, the car radio, and all that kind of stuff? Okay, I'm seeing some stares. That means no. Okay. Which is fine. I just don't want to bore anybody, but this is kind of it's very, very elemental to getting a good mix. Typical Mackie SR24, Yamaha MG212, whatever you got, they always typically have this. You got a bass knob, you got a treble knob, and a mid-range knob, right? Low mids and highs. And then there's this funny fourth knob, and it's labeled frequency or sweep. And so what do we do with this guy? Well, this one relates to this one. This one's pretty easy to figure out. That's volume. If I turn it this way, it's soft. If I turn it this way, it's loud. Soft, loud. If I have, let's say for instance, back to our female vocal. If I have a female vocal, what we may do
take 2 dB off her high end, take 4 dB off her low end, and on her mid-range, I'm going to say, Heather, hey, I was having a little trouble last Sunday getting your voice really right. It just, you did great. It was nothing you were doing. I couldn't get it to really be clean out here. It just sounded kind of brassy. Let me try something today. Could you give me just, if you guys in the band could hold off just a second, I'm going to make it sound a little funny for just a minute. Will you mind, Heather, just sing? I'm going to sweep it around. Your voice is going to sound funny for a minute, but we're going to find what's going on. So I boost the mid-range up to plus 6. I start here at the lowest frequency, typically 100 hertz, and I sweep it around. I start moving it back and forth. This is a plus 6. It'll be at 3 o'clock. I sweep it around. At some point, let's say right here, it just lights up. It just sounds horrible. It starts to ring. It just covers your, you want to just cover your ears. Let's say that it was 550 hertz. So now, I go to minus 6. I take that, sweep it back around, I leave it right where I found it. So I boost it up, sweep it around until it sounds really bad or feeds back or something goes wrong, and then turn this back down. That's it. That's all there is to it. If you do that, your life gets a whole bunch easier because you can solve feedback problems and tonality problems, resonance problems, all these kind of things just go away with that little simple move. Just about any console that's over $1,000 will have that on it. It's, if yours just has low mids and highs, you're kind of limited in what you can do. But that sweep works just like an old car stereo. Back when we had 2 knobs and a dial. And this was volume, and that was your frequency. And you turned it up, and you turned this dial till you found the station you wanted, right? All we're doing is we turn it up, and we find the station we don't want. Find the worst radio station on the dial, we turn it down. You can use that on the acoustic piano, so you're micing the piano, and it just sounds honky. It's like, you know, it's this $30,000 Yamaha Grand, and it sounds like a $500 Spinet. What went wrong? Boost it up, sweep it around till it sounds like a really bad Spinet, and then turn that back down. It works on the vocal mics. It works on choir mics to get rid of the ring. We have the choir mic on. When nobody's up there, just turn the choir mic on, turn the gain up, sweep it around till you make it feed back, and then turn that part down. It really, really works.
So what do you turn it down? What do you turn it down with? Just till it stops feeding back, or go past it a little bit?
Just till it stops feeding back. We don't want to kill the whole tone, okay. Because unfortunately, the console EQ is pretty broadband. So it will give us a really unfortunate thinness if we're too aggressive with it. Mm-hmm. So we typically say we have a 9 and 3 o'clock window that we don't boost or cut any more than 6 dB, which would be from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock.
That makes sense. That's probably the biggest deal that you can get out of any kind of EQ technique, because it's on every channel. The problem is if we do that, if we go over to a graphic EQ and do it, either we're buying 20 graphic EQs, or we're making one part of it better and one part of it worse.
Yeah, I did, and it just
crashed.
It just crashed.
It looked like it rebooted.
Did it reboot?
It sort of looked like it did.
Okay. It's not this thing. There it goes. Let's start from scratch. Then the last part of it is, if we start pulling this mix together, how do we make this work? In a small church, we run into this problem all the time. It's sort of the mixing pyramid. Is that we've got the drums down here, we've got bass, and we've got guitar and keys, and we've got vocals, and we've got our worship leader up here. So we're trying to get the worship leader to be the loudest thing, right? Makes sense. Followed by the BGVs and the melody instruments, the rhythm and the percussion. If we start with this and start adding things on, you know what usually happens? It's too loud. In other words, we get the drums going, add the bass, add the keys and guitar, add the background vocals, and then the worship leader walks up, and there's a lot of energy going on, and he or she steps up there. I'm going to have to turn him or her up a lot to get them on top of this. So what we'll often say is, could we think about, just for one or two Sundays,
could we think about inverting the pyramid? That is, can we think about if we start with the worship leader and add the other instruments behind it? If we can, and again, this is just an exercise. Some churches it works, some churches it won't work. But if I can start up here, and this is the way we do it, the trick we use. Hey guys, we were getting some complaints last Sunday about the volume, and nobody left or anything, but it was just getting a little bit on the edge. Could we do this? Can you guys, let's get the worship leader really loud, because I know she was having a time last week, her voice was a little strained, and I just had the monitors as loud as they'd go. Let's get her really strong and loud so everybody agrees. So we turn on the worship leader, get her up there, get her loud on the monitors, get her loud on the house. Can everybody hear the worship leader? Yes. Can you hear her very strong and clear? Yes. Okay. Let's add the other singers. And we'll add the other singers, and they'll just be a couple of dB less than the worship leader. Can everybody hear them? Yeah. Can you hear her with the worship leader? Yes. Let's add the guitar and keys. Now, what's going to happen at this point is the guitar and keys, they start going, and everything's okay, and then it gets to be, I can't hear the worship leader anymore. Oh, well, before we all agreed we could hear the worship leader, something must have happened. I didn't change anything back here. What happened? Well, we added this. So now, guys, I'm kind of in a position. If I boost the worship leader much more, then we're going to be the same problem we had last Sunday. Can we turn this down and this down a little bit? So that the loudest thing on stage and in the house is this, and everything is subservient to that, since that is our worship leader. See where we're going with this? It's a psychological technique that makes people aware that, oh, I don't have a free ride on this thing. If this is as loud as it can go, I have to be less than that. And again, it gets back to we have to decrease so he can increase kind of application. And we're doing it in a gentle, non-confrontive manner, so that the softest thing then is the drums, which works until the second song, right? And the drums are playing louder. Well, either this whole thing has to shift up, or we have to start doing our whole mess again. It's just an exercise, not that it solves the problem, but just that it makes people aware, hey, I can only be this loud. And so that gives us the ability to say, hey, remember how loud that worship leader was when it was just her? Now she seems to have disappeared in the mix, which means that all this other noise we created have washed her out. So how can we work toward that goal? And we start talking to each other, you know, hey, could you use Blastics? Could you use Hot Rods? Can we put, if you look at drums, let's say that we have, let's see how the best way to describe this. If we have a drum kit, you know, kind of set up around here, and we've got our cymbals and all that stuff. If we put a shield in front of the drums, the nice thing is it keeps the cymbals, if it's tall enough, it keeps the cymbals out of the vocal mic. So that's a big benefit. But it does tend to mess up the drum sound. So the big key, and this is Carl Albrecht's technique, is we want to have 18 inches between the front of the kick drum and that shield. That gives us enough step back that if I'm miking, say if I'm miking the kick drum here and I'm miking the snare and I'm miking the overheads here, it gives us enough distance so that that energy reflecting off there is not just making a total mess of the drum mix. It also allows the drummer to not feel encapsulated by this thing. That means, though, that instead of it being a 5-panel wide, you know, most of the time we were doing a 5-panel kind of thing, is we end up sometimes having to do an extra wing because now we're further out and we've got to make sure that this thing gets all the way around the drummer. Another thing that we do that's even more effective than a drum shield, and if you haven't spent the money on a drum shield, this might be a better use of those $500 or so, is if we look at the drums from overhead here, is we put a Versa panel behind the drums. The drummer's sitting here, facing out. We put a Versa panel behind the drums, and a Versa panel is a segmented fabric panel. Kind of looks like this. And it's 5 feet tall and 7 feet wide, and it rolls over behind the drums. We did this test at Inspiration a couple years ago with Kurt Typlay and I, where we discovered that if we had a shield and we put it up drummers here, and we measured the volume on the stage right here and dropped that shield, there was 1 dB difference, almost none, because the energy just bounced up and down there anyway. If we took the Versa panel behind the drums and we put it up, it dropped 8 dB on stage, which is huge. 10 dB is half volume. So we cut a huge amount of volume by putting this behind the drum. So the drummer was happy because he wasn't blocked, but it just encapsulated him, and it's about that thick, and they simply roll up like this, and they're used for room dividers in churches. So you've often seen them as it's a half moon kind of thing that they'll put like this in a situation. So you walk into a temporary classroom in a gym, Versa panel, but it's VERSI-PANEL.com. Company's Mighty Lights, based in Phoenix, make a great product. It's not even designed originally as a drum shield. It was designed as a room divider, but I started using it a few years ago for that, and it just worked out really, really well. About $500. It's a wonderful investment.
That will help the stage.
The whole stage thing. Yeah. In fact, what we've done sometimes is put one there and put one around the bass player and put one around the guitar player. And now that energy, and then we have them face, so if he's standing here, we have him face his amp, you know, toward him like this. And then if this is coming around here, the back wave is encapsulated. And he gets his amp, and it just drops the volume 10 or 12 dB. So if he won't give up his amp, that's a good way around it. It's a really cool technique. We use this all the time. When we're out with, we do a lot of the tours for Faith Nights with Third Coast Sports, where they go to AA and AAA ball fields and we do a Christian concert. We use this all the time because we're on a small, tight stage and it's always loud. And this, we use 3 Versa panels and bang, the mix just clears up. It's a really cool technique. Come in like 30 colors so you can color match it and all that kind of stuff.
What do they run a piece?
About $500, something like that. You can order it direct. Yeah, they come either 4 foot or 5 foot tall. We really recommend the 5 foot version, 7 feet wide. Great product. Anything else? Any of that not make sense?
Mm-hmm. Is it? Good in a hall. You have to, church is in a hall.
Yes.
And have a lot of echo.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, the other thing that we do, especially in a portable church environment, since this thing rolls up, and you just put a Velcro strap around it, is at the back, you know, like a lot of churches that we work with, they meet in a gym or they meet in a cafeteria at a school. On the back wall, we'll line 3 of them up along the back wall like this, and that becomes the council meeting rooms, you know, for people that need counseling on an altar call, and it also serves as a great diffusion panel at the back of the room. It busts up all that nasty slap back. And it covers up all that ugly cinder block. Anything else? Lauren, good to see you, sir.
Hey, Ken.
This is Lauren. He is the manager for 11 states, is that right?
All the western states.
All the western states for Avion, the company with the little blue boxes we've been talking about that we just love. Are we out of time? Oh, okay. Any since it's our sort of our last class, I know some of you guys have been wonderful to be in most of the classes yesterday and today. Anything that didn't make sense or that we need to cover or say, well, how do we get rid of this problem? Yes, sir.
In a small sanctuary setting, mm-hmm. I'm talking we're set up. We can seat 130.
Okay.
Ceilings, vaulted ceiling,
right.
Flat back wall, straight sides.
Yeah.
Typical, don't consult any
right.
sound people
yeah.
when you build it situations. Yeah. Would it be beneficial to even pull with a subwoofer and roll the lows?
Yeah, it basically looks like this. In other words, you're in this kind of a speakers you've got now, are they pretty full range?
Yeah, they're full range.
Are you missing kind of that fundamental, that last octave, that fundamental tone of authority?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. I would be more tempted just to buy up what you've already got, and then that way you can control just the highs and lows independently, assuming that the speaker, do you know what kind of speaker it is?
No.
Okay, that's fine. But on the back of your speaker, most better quality speakers will have on the input plate, they'll usually have three inputs. One is full range, which you normally plug into. Then this one usually has a little bar over and it says biamp. And it allows you to send a power amplifier signal from here just to the woofer and from here just to the compression driver. So now you've got the ability to turn up just the highs and lows independently of each other. And what that gives you is one more step of control. It also makes the system 3 dB more efficient, which is, in other words, if you're powering it with an 800 watt power amp now, it would be as if you went out and bought another 800 watt power amp. So it doubles the efficiency of the system, and it gives you independent control. Plus, it allows you to select where we're going to cross over. So if we had a situation that you might have a resonance in the room around 800 hertz, what we can do is use the crossover and dip it down at 800 on purpose, and not even reproduce those frequencies that are going to be a naturally occurring resonance. In other words, if you don't produce it, then you don't have to cut it. That would be a strong option, because a crossover is going to only run you $150. And then if it's a biamp capable box, then it's just simply a matter of running the second cable to the unit. Yes, sir. Right. Right. And this is, Mackie was, to their credit, was trying to look out for this situation. What they've got, in their summing amplifiers, they have resistor networks that zero is really six down. And you can argue both sides of the fence on this one, but they did what they did and they had good reason to do it. So what I would look at is on our power amplifiers, if we brought those down and then brought the level up on the master of, in other words, get more gain coming out of the board so that the amplifiers are not having to have their sensitivity so high. Are you getting a lot of hiss out of the system now? Is it?
Yeah, it's real hissy.
I would definitely take on the power amplifier those two sensitivity knobs, which are probably right now set like that.
They're more at like 2 o'clock.
Okay, they're 2 o'clock. You might be able to bring them down all the way to 12 o'clock here, and then go back to the console and bring up our gain here until at least the meter reads somewhere like minus 6, if we could do that. Where's the meter typically reading now?
Same spot about
2 o'clock. Oh, I'm sorry, where's the meter reading? Oh, no, I'm sorry, on the Mackie, the actual ladder LEDs, the LED ladders.
Oh, geez.
Is it just flashing a couple at the bottom?
No, it's something yellow in there.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought you were getting... Okay, so you're getting good, strong signal out of there.
Yeah. Just.
What's in the chain between the console and the amplifier?
An equalizer.
MEQ-230? It was wonderful 15 years ago when it got. It was the first laser cut. That's a laser cut front end and all that. But the only problem with that is you don't have a lot of headroom in that Lesis EQ. Now, the little white switch, you have to put your thumb in on the very edge and pull down for the in out. If you pull it out, can you hear a big volume difference?
Yeah.
Okay, that's where we need to make up our gain. Remember, we talked about that in the Novit class. We want to take the overall volume for the EQ and turn it up so that whether we're in or out, the volume is about the same. That's where we're losing our signal. That's it. If we do that, then you can leave. You might be able to bring this down to 12 o'clock. Your console's fine. Mackie, is it a CFX or a DFX or a...
It's a CFX.
Okay. It doesn't have quite the headroom like a 1604 would, but it's still a good console. So I think you're fine there. But if we can definitely bring the overall gain up on the Lesis EQ, so and then go in and out, and the tonal change from your adjustments.
Yeah, I think right now it's the zero mark on the EQ.
Okay. That would be, you know, one thing to definitely check and to get our gain back up on that EQ. Good question. Yes, sir.
Dealt with dynamics and condensers as far as killing feedback.
Right.
One time we had a guest that was on the wireless belt.
Yeah. The problem with the lapel, in other words, if you take this mic and you hold it out here, yeah, no problem. Yeah, but when the problem is if you take any mic and hold it out here, you have free air resonance. If you put it here, you have reflective surfaces, right. Plus you're now, since sound travels faster through a denser medium, the sound's going faster through your body than it is through the air. So it's showing up in this mic earlier than it is acoustically. So you already have a problem right off the bat. What we try to do is this. We try to get the lapel mic just... Is your church a tie-wearing kind of church? Is it...
Sometimes.
Okay. if they wear a tie, just below the knot.
So
yeah. We put it in the center, just below the knot of the tie. Then we take, even if it's an omnidirectional mic, we take and we bend the clip out just a little bit to try to get it off the body. Yeah. Now, did you have any popping problems or anything like that?
No, just like screaming in four different.
One thing you can do if it if you get a popping or anything like that, if it's an omnidirectional mic, just turn it upside down. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
and it won't pop then, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, it will definitely help. The problem is yours probably is a directional mic because directional cardioids tend to sizzle a lot. Is it a Sennheiser? Yours if yours is, Sennheiser's sparkle a lot around 8K. So if you can take on that console of yours and turn down 8,000 hertz, that's where the S's are coming through really hard. Yeah, Sennheiser is known for that. Yeah, the E6 Countryman ear set mic is just a wonderful product. The only problem we have with it does this. It tends to do this a lot. They've got a new version that doesn't. If you can afford it, the world's best headset mic in the whole wide world. This is for when you get lots and lots of money. It's a DPA 4088F. This is the best headset mic. This is what we use with Toby Mac. It's what we use with Tommy Walker. This thing works. And it never... ever quits. This is a Brulin Kajir. This is a Danish mic, and it's around $750, but it is just, it's the kit, the killer piece. And just, you buy it, you never have to EQ it, you never have to touch it, you can put it on the cheapest Radio Shack PA, and it sounds like $1 million. Yes, sir.
One
more? Sure.
Just a gain staging question.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's called simultaneous system clipping. That's what, right. An intelligent way to do it is that everything distorts at the same time. Everything runs out of gas at the same time. Yeah. Makes sense. Good question. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, sir. Right.
So you're saying that she's not going to be frequently,
well,
so you're saying take
Right now, if she's a sopranist, in other words, we've got a, she a sopranist, mezzo sopranist, she's an alto. What range does she sing in?
Well, I just mean I would want to try to add some bass to what they're putting out, but you're saying they're not producing that
right
frequency, then it's
yeah.
Not
in other
happen.
Words. If she's a sopranist, then below 220 hertz, she can't really make any sound. I mean, she can make some sound, but it's not in her vocal range. So the bass knob is down around 80 hertz, so there's not much point in adding anything there because I would have, even though this is a shelving curve, I'd have to get it to like plus 10 before it ever reaches.